to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Martin Handley.
Yes, thank you very much indeed, John. Hello and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, where tonight Vasily Sinaisky appears for the last time as chief guest conductor of the BBC Philharmonic, a Russian who's made quite a reputation in recent years for his insightful, idiomatic conducting of English repertoire. This evening, he reveals his thoughts on some more of it.
For me, this music is very, very close to my heart because I find it very, very serious, very interesting, and it's very special language, musical language. And for me, Elgar is quite clear in his ideas and in his music. It's so romantic, you see, and close to German romantic music, which I like very, very much. So I understand a lot of things. But of course, harmonies and sort of orchestration, it's really unusual for me. So I spend a lot of time to learn it.
Vasily Sinaisky. Well, there is one German romantic interloper on his programme, the Brahms Violin Concerto. But I hear you say I listened to Christian Tetzlaff playing it last Sunday evening on Radio 3. Well, tonight that work becomes Brahms' third piano concerto, as it were. Arranged, and it took him 6 years, and performed by the gifted young Croatian Dejan Lazic. Otherwise, though, it's all English, ending with Elgar's iconic Enigma variations. And cellist Julian Lloyd-Webber is a passionate advocate of Holst's Invocation, which tonight finally receives its proms premiere. But we begin with the last completed piece by the still very underappreciated Frank Bridge, who 70 years after his death is one of the composers this year's proms is focusing on. He was 60 at the start of the war, and with only a little over a year to live, he wouldn't have served even had he been younger, being a gentle pacifist in the description of his pupil Benjamin Britten, but someone who nonetheless railed against the conflict. Though far from well, Bridge took in evacuees from London and was at work on an orchestral piece for Henry Wood to premiere at the proms. The Blitz meant that concert was postponed and Bridge didn't live to hear a performance. He'd begun the work before the war, an overture to be called Rumour, but once the war was underway, he felt that was a word associated with treachery and brutality and renamed the overture Rebus. Now, the dictionary says Rebus is a kind of graphic riddle, an enigmatic representation of words in pictures. So what was Bridge getting at? Perhaps he wasn't changing what he was trying to express, simply losing any direct association with the war. He seems to be saying that ideas, thoughts, or images can become distorted and transform something innocent into many other things, including the macabre and the violent. But however enigmatic its meaning, the musical style is direct and extrovert. Very full hall, as we are want to see in this season, and a full platform too, with the BBC Philharmonic, its leader, just coming onto the platform now, Yuri Tochinsky. Swiftly followed by the one figure in white, everybody else in tails and black dresses, Vasily Sinaisky, to conduct Frank Bridge's overture, Rebus.
Thank you.
Frank Bridges' last completed work, his overture Rebus, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to begin this BBC Prom live on Radio 3 by the BBC Philharmonic with its chief guest conductor, Vasily Sinaisky. Bridge himself should have conducted the first performance of Rebus in the 1940 Proms season. It was cancelled, and the first performance was given in memoriam the next year by Thomas Beecham. Well, there's a piano move now as we turn from Bridge to another featured composer of this year's prom season, Brahms, and the UK premiere of his violin concerto. premiere, violin concerto. Well, it was said when it was composed that it was a concerto written against the violin, so is it for the piano? I asked tonight's soloist and Prom's debut artist Dejan Lazic to explain.
You know, I think of Brahms' music in general as very abstract music, and it's not necessarily written for an instrument. And since Brahms' music does come from Bach and Beethoven, and since these two composers were my inspirations, you know, sources of inspiration, because they arranged their own violin concertos, I sort of just filled in the missing link, I thought.
Had you always thought of this as a great concerto that you felt was missing from the pianist's canon?
Definitely. I mean, it is definitely different kind of an instrumental concerto if one compares them the other concertos by Brahms, piano concertos, or the double concerto for violin and cello. So this has a special place, I believe, in Brahms' legacy. And I believe this concerto is not necessarily written for violin nor for piano in this case, but for Joseph Joachim. Since Joachim was a violinist, I mean, he, kindly enough, really did most of the violin part at least make it more playable. The recording with Heifetz and Chicago Symphony and Rainer conducting. That was actually my first LP I've ever heard. And ever since, I wanted to play the violin. So next to the correspondence and all the objective reasons and sources of inspiration, this is maybe also partly the reason why I did this. And this amazing concerto has always been there with me. Many of Brahms' own transcriptions and arrangements encouraged me to do something like this. And I really should point out that nothing can replace the violin concerto. It is, of course, subjectively for me, alongside maybe Beethoven's fourth piano concerto, the most magnificent instrumental concerto. And my arrangement is actually coming out of respect and admiration for this concerto. And just, I wanted to experiment a bit and put it into new setting for piano and the orchestra, and it seems it really works.
Dejan Lazic, who hasn't changed the note of Brahms' orchestration, but apart from rewriting the solo part in his best Brahmsian style, he has composed a new cadenza for the first movement, the original that Joachim provided for his friend's concerto, being simply too violinistic. A splendid heave-ho there. Well, Brahms was never interested in the showy kind of piece where the soloist stands alone in the spotlight and the orchestra provides what's essentially a background. For him, the soloist is the principal character in a drama whose music and that of the orchestra are woven together into a seamless whole. He took his model from Beethoven's groundbreaking violin concerto, and as in that work, Brahms' violin writing, though often fiendish, is never emptily virtuosic. And he was lucky, as Dejan was saying, to have the violinist and composer Joseph Joachim, for whom he wrote his concerto, as a close friend. Yuri Torchinsky learns to play the piano, as you heard. Well, Brahms finished the first draft on summer holiday and sent the violin part of the first movement to Joachim for his opinion, asking him to mark passages that were difficult, awkward, or impossible to play. And their dialogue continued right up until the first performance and beyond, Joachim suggesting that the piece was so symphonic it really needed a different solo instrument. Brahms didn't agree, but that was just the kind of remark to encourage Dejan Lazic in his transcription. I can't wait to hear it on the piano. The piano is now in place, the slightly reduced BBC Philharmonic, ready for pianist, arranger, and conductor to take their places. Somebody thinks they're coming. And there they are. Dapper, as always, Dejan Lazic, followed by Vasily Sinaisky, joining the BBC Philharmonic to perform Dejan's own arrangement of Brahms' violin concerto as, if you like, a third piano concerto. The UK premiere of what's billed as Brahms' third piano concerto, alias his violin concerto arranged for piano by tonight's soloist Dejan Lazic. He performed the concerto here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, with the BBC Philharmonic conducted by Vasily Sinaisky. And Dejan Lazic making his Proms debut tonight as pianist and, you might say, as arranger. Well, violinists, as he was saying to me earlier, always had a bit of a problem with that, at least when it was first written. The Spanish violinist Sarasate flatly refused to play it. Do you think, he said, I'd stand there with my violin in my hand and listen while the oboe plays the only melody in the entire piece? Well, very beautifully it was played tonight by Jennifer Galloway, principal oboe of the BBC Philharmonic. Dejan Lazic back on the platform with Vasily Sinaisky, who, of course, gets Jenny Galloway to her feet. Well, Dejan Lazic say, he always tried to imagine what Brahms, the pianist, would have written. First performance was of his arrangement in Atlanta in 2009, the Dutch premiere next month. And I last spoke to him, he said, told me he was writing his own piano concerto. Well, he's still writing his own piano concerto. And he's about to go on tour with the Budapest Festival Orchestra and Ivan Fischer to Spain, Italy and Germany, playing Liszt. And you can hear them in the Totentanz with Mahler's First Symphony here at the Proms. I think that's the 3rd of September. Back comes Dejan Lazic. Says he might have a holiday in December. And something else. Schumann's Freundliche Landschaft, pleasant landscape from his Waldszenen and Scenes of the Forest, such a symbol of the Romantic movement. Schumann following Brahms. Lots of Brahms next week with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, Bernard Haitink and Emmanuel Ax in the real piano concertos number 1 and 2. Well, after the interval, the BBC Philharmonic and Vasily Sinaisky turn their gaze back on British music. There's a rarity, the Proms premiere of Holst's Invocation for Cello and Orchestra, in which the soloist is Julian Lloyd Webber, and music that's very well known indeed. Perhaps all the more interesting to hear Sinaisky's view of Elgar's Enigma Variations. But for the next 20 minutes, before Julian Lloyd Webber brings his cello on stage, ceramics expert and failed cellist Lars Tharp considers whether there's something about cellos.
The cello. It's the only instrument that starts with an apostrophe. I've been an amateur cellist since I was 8. I went on to join several chamber groups and school orchestras, including the LSO. That's the Leicestershire Schools Orchestra. Then there were the yearly school house music competitions. At one of them, our visiting judge came up to me after I'd played. Would I be interested in moving on to an internationally acknowledged cello teacher? He said he'd personally recommend me to someone called Paul Tortelier. For a week, I discussed this with my parents, but no, I just didn't want to grind away for 6 hours a day, mostly scales and arpeggios. So a hobby it stayed. But as a listener, rather than a player, I've grown more and more fond of the cello voice. There's something special about the cello. But what is it? Why do so many people say, it's my favourite instrument, and, ooh, I wish I'd play the cello?
Maybe it's a cliché, but it really is the instrument that's closest to the human voice in its whole range. And in fact, this whole piece I'm playing is remarkable for the fact that it really does use the lower parts of the cello, the very base of the cello, and also the very top of the cello. So it really goes from one extreme to the other.
Hearing Julian Lloyd Webber, one of our most distinguished cellists, describing the range of this piece by Gustav Holst, I can't wait to hear it. But I'm also interested to know how Julian came to the instrument in the first place.
I was taken to a children's concert around the age of four, orchestral concert at the festival hall, and I spotted the cello in the orchestra. So I wasn't really hearing it as a solo instrument, and I thought it looked a very natural instrument to play. And I was kind of intrigued by the look of how somebody played it.
I hesitate to make a comparison, but it was me seeing a cello being played that had the same effect. I was old, I was eight, and I'd seen a cello being played in the school on Friday assembly. That was when it came out. And I thought, well, that looks interesting, that looks fun, you know. And I don't know, there is something about the physicality, isn't there, when you see someone playing this instrument.
I think you can see exactly how the sound is produced and how the notes are made. You can watch the fingers very clean. See, an instrument, to me, like the oboe or the is it, and even the trumpet, you know, those instruments are a mystery to me, how people are playing so high, so low. The cello, you can see the whole thing.
Yeah. Do you know, I'd never thought of it in those terms. You can absolutely see that when climbing up towards the bridge. And
exactly. And you can, I know, it's exciting. And you can even see, you know, the low strings and the whole thing. I mean, it's absolutely visible.
Yeah.
The older I got, the more I became intrigued by the music that had been written for the cello, and particularly at that time, you seem to hear the same pieces again and again. And I was interested in the lesser-known pieces, and I built up a massive collection of tapes off the radio, and anything that had a solo cello in it, I would tape it. And I've still got a lot of extraordinary tapes like that, probably illegal, but there you go. I mean, I was collecting obscure cello concertos like other little boys were collecting cigarette cards. Let's put it like that.
Was there any particular body of music that really spurred you on when you were learning?
Well, I had a wonderful teacher who, way beyond the call of her duty, she started taking me when I was 10, 11 to hear great cellists in concert. So I was very lucky to see people like Pierre Fournier, who, strangely enough, I later studied with. I saw Fournier, Tourtellier, Jacqueline Dupré, but then, of course, the one who made the huge impact on me was Rostropovich. And perhaps it wasn't only the way that he played, it was also his interest in broadening the cello repertoire. So he came over when I was about 13, 14, and did this extraordinary series in London of 9 concerts, and he did something like 35 concertos in just over 2 weeks. It was unbelievable, and played everything from memory. And, of course, besides the usual Dvorak and Elgar, you know, we had an amazing number of cello concertos which I'd never heard in my life before, which was, it was like manna from heaven for me. I was just transfixed. I went to every concert.
I was lucky to meet Mstislav Rostropovich a few years later in the mid-1970s, whilst I was a student at Cambridge. He and his wife had just been banished from their Russian homeland. They were celebrity refugees. Rostropovich was billed to give a concert in King's College Chapel. When the cellists in the university orchestra saw the price of the tickets, an astronomic £5, we ummed and ahed. But the moment we received individual invitations to meet the maestro after the concert, there was a stampede for the tickets. And on that night, we weren't disappointed. The cavernous space of the chapel was packed. The burly figure of Rostropovich emerged into a small pool of light under the chapel's towering dark Gothic screen. An absolute silence descended. When he started to play, the darkened space was filled with colours, right up to the fan-vaulted ceiling. Every minute inflection, the occasional shift of fingers on string, every change of tone and phrasing filled the space. The man, the music, and the cello were one.
The cello's a very tactile instrument. everything you do on it speaks and sounds. A bit more pressure on the bow, a different string that you use for a different effect. Really everything you do comes out immediately to an audience. So perhaps that's why so many people love the cello.
I love the cello because of its huge range, because of its tone colour, and in this particular case, because of the person who's playing it as well.
That person is not Rostropovich, not even Julian Lloyd Webber, but Graham Fitkin is talking about Yo-Yo Ma. Graham has already composed a cello and piano piece for Yo-Yo, but now he's written an entire cello concerto, which will be premiered in Prom No. 61 at the end of the month.
There's an emotional intensity which I find I can't necessarily get from other instruments. And maybe because of that vocal simile, if you like, I think that resonates with the human being as much as any instrument that I know, really. In the woodwind department, I suppose a clarinet maybe has certain similarities. The cello itself, in that sort of soaring, singing, pulling at the heartstrings sort of, I love that. I'm aware of it and I'm aware of the history of it, especially in cello concerti, especially from English composers, Walton and Elgar. And so one of the things for me when I was writing my piece was not to go too far down that road. That's been done so beautifully and so magically by other composers that I wanted still to use the cello for its beautiful qualities, but not quite in the same way. Although the cello is a fantastic instrument and has such a range and a breadth and does all the things I want it to do, really, it's not necessarily the loudest instrument. And so cello concerti through the ages have had a problem with balance with orchestra. And that's one of the things which I had to really identify early on. Okay, the cello goes very high, certainly, but it's not a violin. It doesn't soar over the entire orchestra. So just pitch-wise, the most resonant places for a cello are in a sort of mid to high area, perhaps, where actually we're blessed with a lot of other instruments which can belt out there as well. So, in fact, I had to make sure that there was enough space around the cello constantly. When there wasn't space, then there had to be a good reason for that. And the reason had to be that I wanted the cello at those points to be subsumed by the orchestra.
With orchestra, it's very unusual to find composers writing right down for the bass of the instrument because it's so difficult to come through the texture. But actually, Holst really has done an amazing job. I mean, when this piece was written, which was 1911, the cello writing was very in advance of its time.
Who did you write it for?
I'm not sure if he wrote it for May Mukley, but she certainly gave its first performance. It is a remarkable piece, and it certainly foreshadows some of the ideas that he was trying out for the planets.
The cello has this beautiful quality of holding suspended notes in midair, which are almost visual sometimes. When I worked with Yo-Yo, I went to see him in Berlin, for instance, in January, and we spent the afternoon basically playing one note, and he sustained one note for a long time, and I wrote down all the things he was doing to it to make it sound slightly different, or very, very different, to how he was getting all the harmonics to come out at certain points, how the bow changed, how he could add another string in, so the same note was doubled, actually, how he could detune a third string, how we can get not just neighbouring strings to sound, but the bottom and the top string on the same note. It was fascinating for me to work, as I thought, well, I'd like him to play one note for a while and see what happens. But actually, he blew my mind with the amount of things that you could do with one note.
You hear five cellists play the Elgar or Dvorak, they will all be different. I don't think the disease where everybody sounds the same has affected the cello as much as some instruments.
Yeah. I must say, I have a personal anathema against massed cellos. The famous Bachianus Brasiliarus, number 6 or
yes,
number 5.
Yes, number 5.
Number 5. I'm afraid I...
It
doesn't do it for
me. This is very strange. And I mean, you should hear the Hymnus by Klengel, which can be for any number of cellos. It's actually for 12 cellos, but you can double up or quadruple up. It sounds marvellous. So you're not into the sort of Berlin Philharmonic cello section.
It doesn't do it. But what does it for me is something like the Schubert Quintet, where you've got these two cellos in parallel.
Adds a richness, doesn't
it?
Yeah,
wonderful. It's just richness. Stunning. Yeah. And the Brahms sextets. I think are wonderful.
Yeah.
But that's because the cellos are being individuals.
I mean, the cello really is the romantic instrument par excellence.
Delving further back into the cello repertoire, beyond Brahms and Beethoven, and into the 18th century, we come to the unaccompanied cello suites of Johann Sebastian Bach. Once believed to be mere exercises, they were exhumed from oblivion in the early 20th century by the man who put the cello centre stage, Pablo Casals.
I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said that he was fed up with going to all these cello recitals and hearing something that sounded like a blue bottle stuck in a jam jar. But this was probably pre-Casals, or certainly pre the influence of Casals, because basically he did create a revolution technically. The way he played the cello, he avoided all these massive glissandos up and swooping sounds, which if you hear very early cello recordings, they are rather too prevalent. And I think Casals opened the way, really, for modern cello playing and what we have today.
And it is an incredibly physical instrument, isn't it? I mean, I think it surely must require more stamina and leaping around than, well, the piano.
I tell you, when it does require stamina, it's carrying it around the world. It's a heavy thing to carry, along with your cases and everything else. Pianists don't have to do that, do they?
Absolutely. My dear, it could come in useful if the ship goes down, that's what they say.
I'm not commenting on that.
You get lots of funny comments when you're carrying a cello around, like, how do you get it under your chin? That's the usual one.
And people always think it's the first time you've heard.
You have to say, oh.
Give us a tune, mate.
Yeah.
And look out, he's got a machine gun.
My favourite one was getting off a bus in Leicestershire and the Clippy saying to me, have you had it since it was a violin, mate?
That's not bad, really.
Well, it's certainly the best. How many cellos have you got?
I've only got my Stradivarius. I'm very fortunate to play this cello. It's a beautiful instrument made in around 1690. It was played by the Russian cellist Alexandra Barjansky, who was very active in the 20s and 30s of last century. And rather strangely, he was the dedicatee of Bloch's Shalomo, but he gave the first performance of the Delius cello concerto, which is perhaps a little bit more unexpected.
Yeah, it is. Now, Shlomo, that's an interesting piece because although Bloch himself was not Jewish, he felt very strongly.
And
this piece is one of the most extraordinary piece of heart-wrenching.
It is, and it's rather dropped out of the repertoire, hasn't it? Which I find strange, but it these things do come and go with fashion, but Shlomo was a piece that used to be played all the time, and now you very rarely see it in concert.
That brings me to the other side of this coin. There are one or two people I've come across who've said, the cello, such a sad instrument. Now, I disagree with that, but it's certainly capable of delivering sadness in buckets.
Yes, it is. I mean, one can get quite depressed sometimes practising some of the cello repertoire that it's so... I think a lot of composers left their big cello work almost to the end, so it's got their deepest emotion in. You think of Dvorak and Schumann and Shostakovich, number two. These are very, very deep works, and there can be a sadness there. But then, on the other hand, you think of a piece like the Tchaikovsky Rococo Variations, the Haydn C major concerto with his amazing bubbly finale, and even the Shostakovich number one, But I wouldn't say that sorrow was at the heart of those works. The cello can express all kinds of different emotions. It's just that quite often composers use it to express their inner sadness.
One name you haven't mentioned in the repertoire, Bach.
Well, I mean, Bach, it's such an extraordinary thing, really, because Bach suites were amongst the first pieces written for cello. And there they are, these solo cello masterpieces, which for a long time were just thought to be studies until Casals came along and showed that music could be made with them. And they probably are still, the pinnacle, the peak of the repertoire.
Do you play them every day?
I avoid them most of the time. that's not far from the truth. I think that they're wonderfully great, great works. They've been played by every cellist through history. And for me, I find it more of a challenge to take on new pieces and find new things, and it's really something I've always tried to do. It's not that I've avoided standard repertoire, because I've played virtually everything except the Bach suites, which I've played very few times. I have done them.
The modern cello is a descendant of the old violoncello, as denoted by its spelling, with its initial apostrophe, a contraction of the former name. Though I note today that even the BBC Proms programme has dropped this ancestral remnant. It was in the Cremona workshop of Antonio Stradivarius that the modern violin family was refined to the proportions we see today, so that throughout the 18th century, the once much larger violoncello reduced in size, allowing it to become the present-day virtuoso instrument. Julian's own cello is an early example from the celebrated Cremonese workshop.
Many of the cellos, including mine, I think, have been slightly cut down because they were made to a bigger size. But you're absolutely right. By the later Stradivarius cellos, the size was set, really, and it hasn't changed.
And we're sitting right next to your cello case here, which I imagine contains the famous Strad.
Yes.
You can't travel everywhere with that. Surely there must be times when you take a collapsible cello.
No. I probably should do, but I use this cello all the time because it's my sound, so it wouldn't make sense to me to play a not-so-good cello.
I wasn't suggesting in concert. I was thinking if you go off for a weekend to Norfolk, do you take your cello with
yes,
you?
Yes, well, I do, actually, unless I've got a cello that costs 25 quid. But say I was going on holiday, which is something I don't often do because I get bored, I would possibly take that just to do like 15 minutes a day, keep the fingers going. But if I'm really working on something or learning something, I have to really learn it on the Strad.
So how long have you owned the Strad?
My bank manager acquired this in 1983 from Sotheby's.
Back in the late 1960s, when I was still having lessons, Paul Tortelier appeared on the TV with a masterclass series of his own. One week, he's teaching the explosive Brahms F major sonata to a talented, if rather demure, young pupil. She gets to a powerful passage where the player really has to lay into doubled-up triplets on the D string. Tortelier stops her and says, very good, but you play this like this. And then he plays it. You play this like a virgin. And then he turns on her with a wild expression and shouts, but no! And then he really lays into the passage as if the string and the bow hairs are going to break. It must be like this, like a great ball of fire. I remembered this episode when I watched Jack Nicholson rehearsing Susan Sarandon playing the Dvorak cello concerto in a film of John Updike's The Witches of Eastwick.
For me, the moment in that film is when the whole cello bursts into flames. Yeah. I mean, that is fantastic. Yeah. It's a great piece of cinema.
But the funny thing is, you know, it's not far off the truth. That's what Rostropovich does in some of the passages in that concerto, for
Absolutely.
Me.
And that's where you can really see the passion, you know, and the breaking of the hairs on the bone, not on the head, and the sweat and the tears.
Well, I mean, it is quite literally orgasmic. It really is.
It can be.
I was talking to somebody last week and said, I'm going to speak to a very eminent cellist. And she said, I like dating cellists.
Oh. Did you take her number?
Well, I was wondering whether it was a come-on, but she was being deadly serious. Do people wait for you to come out of the stage door waiting to date you?
Well, there was a sort of category of a certain type of lady that does hang around outside classical musicians' dressing rooms. But perhaps this is not the subject for a prom interval talk.
But I imagine the cello is more likely to get targeted than the viola section.
Well, there was a poll in Muso magazine which said that cellists made the best lovers.
Really?
Yes,
so it's official.
That was a poll, yes, official according to Muso magazine.
One of the things which is fascinating about, I don't know if I should say this really, but actually to grab an instrument between your legs and play it is such an unusual thing to do. I mean, most instruments, you don't do that. There's a few percussion instruments you might do that, but to actually grab it between your legs and sort of surround it, I find both absorbing to watch somebody do that, and especially when they get that sound out of it. Sometimes, you know, a woman will actually hitch up her skirts and sort of grab the thing, and it's, you know, it's quite something to witness, especially when there's masses of people around, you know.
Composer Graham Fitkin ending Lars Tharp's discovery that there's something about the cello. The producer was Mario Burgess. Well, it seems to be that cellists make the best lovers. It's official. Welcome back to A Pact. Ron Abitbol from me, Martin Handley, in the second half of tonight's prom, live, of course, on Radio 3. The orchestra is the BBC Philharmonic, with its chief guest conductor making his last appearance as such, Vasily Sinaisky. And the music in this part of the evening is entirely English, ending with Elgar's magnificent set of orchestral portraits of his family and friends, his Enigma variations. But first, something much less well-known, receiving its Proms premiere tonight, the Invocation for Cello and Orchestra by Holst, for which the soloist is a passionate advocate of the piece, Julian Lloyd Webber. Holst wrote just this one work for cello and orchestra exactly 100 years ago. It's music that stands on the cusp of his maturity as a composer, still romantic, but with a new succinctness and directness. Julian Lloyd Webber thinks it an astonishingly assured work in its writing for both orchestra and solo instrument. At rehearsal, I asked him how he first found out about Invocation.
It goes back a long way now, because probably around the early 80s, I was in touch with Colin Matthews, who was very involved with the Holst Foundation, I think it was, and Imogen Holst in particular. Now, Imogen had written about this piece in one of her biographies of her father, and she'd been slightly dismissive of it. And I think Colin and me, we both worked very hard to change her mind, and afterwards she was very pleased with it, and it, a lot of it foreshadows the planets. I think he was trying out ideas, and actually I really do think it's a stunning piece.
There's,
I
mean, that Venus, pre-echoes of Venus in the planets.
Yes, and you know, the cello writing is quite extraordinary, because he uses the absolute extremities of the instrument, which in concerto writing cello and orchestra, that's pretty unusual, especially the bottom string. Really, composers tend to avoid that. And there's Holst using it a lot for the main thematic material. And then, of course, he really uses the top of the cello. I don't know of anything else quite like this in the whole repertoire.
It's a 10-minute piece, but can you describe its journey a little musically?
It starts off with the cello completely alone. Then the woodwind come in and the cello accompanies with these sixths underneath. And gradually the piece sort of opens out, the orchestra take over, and there builds to a sort of mini-climax, and then the cello has these two interesting cadenzas that go from the very bottom of the instrument to the highest possible point. And then this beautiful melody comes in, and then another even more beautiful melody comes in the second section, and it gradually builds to this extraordinary moment where the trumpet blasts in right over the top of the orchestra, and the strings are doing these rapid arpeggio figures, and then the cello takes that over and it builds to a wonderful climax. Then it all dies down again, and the cello lands up again at the end, completely solo and with a quite alarming last note.
Julian Lloyd Webber, and here he is on the Royal Albert Hall platform with Vasily Sinaisky, joining the BBC Philharmonic to give the Proms premiere of Holst's Invocation for Cello and Orchestra.
Thank you.
Solo cello singing the music away into silence at the end of Holst's invocation for cello and orchestra, just being given its proms premiere here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3 by Julian Lloyd Webber with the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Vasily Sinaisky. Well, in his programme note, Callum MacDonald suggests that in spirit that invocation is related to the Sanskrit works which have been occupying Holst's imagination for some years, and the vocal sound of the cello's music relates to the folk singers he heard on his collecting expeditions with his friend Vaughan Williams. Both those seem absolutely right. Julian Lloyd Webber back on the platform with the BBC Philharmonic, and Vasily Sinaisky bringing Jamie Prophet to his feet, the principal trumpet of the BBC Philharmonic. Well, there's more Holst on September the 7th, the Planets. Oh, and some more music now.
Serenata from First Suite for Cello by Benjamin Britten.
The Serenata from Britten's Cello Suite No. 1, Julian Lloyd Webber's encore after the Holst, written by Britten in the mid-60s for Rostropovich. Now, Julian said that, like Rostropovich, he doesn't like holidays. Told the story of told to take one, Rostropovich, by his doctor, and he enjoyed it for precisely 2 days. Back comes Julian Lloyd Webber. Blue shirt. Well, as I was saying, the Planets on September the 7th with Frank Bridges' Isabella. Well, the final work on the BBC Philharmonic and Vasily Sinaisky's proms programme is the piece with which Elgar gained international recognition after years of struggle. It began its journey when one evening after supper, having spent the day teaching the violin in Malvern, the composer sat down at the piano, lit himself a cigar and began to improvise. His wife Alice said she liked the tune he came up with. "What is it?" she asked. "Well, nothing yet," came the reply, "but something might be made of it." And he began to play variations on the theme, describing friends of theirs as he played. By the end of the weekend, his new work, The Enigma Variations, was underway. Music of which, when he heard it, Richard Strauss said, "Here for the first time is an English composer who has something to say." And he said it in a masterpiece on a symphonic scale, using the theme and variation form and clothed with brilliant orchestral colour. The theme itself seems likely to represent Elgar, or as he put it, it expresses my sense of the loneliness of the artist. But what about Elgar's remark that another and larger theme runs through the whole set of variations, but is not played? Well, some have tried to suggest it's another tune, maybe something like Rule Britannia, but then why did Elgar say it was something that permeated all the variations, but not the theme itself? Surely it's much more likely to be the friendship or love that links the people characterised in the 14 variations. The first of them, a dignified tribute to his wife Alice, before the warm-up routines at the piano of a pianist friend are gently sent up. Then comes an amateur actor whose performances as old men so amused Elgar. And then there's a rather bombastic country squire who, as we hear, had a tendency to slam the door when he left a room. Richard P. Arnold, son of the poet Matthew, was another amateur pianist whose playing, said Elgar, evaded difficulties but suggested in a mysterious way the real feeling. And a little joke from Elgar involving an amateur violist friend having to cross from one string to another without catching the one in the middle. The seventh variation is Arthur Troyt Griffith, a Malvern architect who Elgar attempted to teach to play the piano without much success. Music lover Winifred Norbury's graceful house is the heart of her portrait, though you can hear her laugh too. Then the unforgettable Nimrod, the nickname of Elgar's close friend A.J. Jaeger. They'd been enthusing about Beethoven's slow movements one evening. The music specifically refers to Beethoven's Pathétique piano sonata. We hear of Dora Penny, a young woman with a slight stammer with whom Elgar liked to flirt, and a sound portrait of the bulldog Dan, who Elgar was very fond of. Belonged to the organist of Hereford Cathedral, Dan falls into the river, swims upstream and scrambles out with a delighted bark. Basil Neverson's variation showed he was a good cellist and a devoted friend, before the 13th variation with just three stars at the top. They refer to Lady Mary Lygon about to embark on a voyage to Australia, hence the clarinet quote from Mendelssohn's Calm Sea and Prosperous Voyage. And finally, the rambustious E.D.U., or rather Alice's nickname for her husband, Edu, the composer portraying himself as more determined and more confident than he really was. So now, back onto the platform here in this warm and packed Albert Hall comes Vasily Sinaisky to conduct the BBC Philharmonic in Elgar's Enigma Variations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Elgar had real problems at the end of the Enigma. He made a large-scale revision, introduced the organ, as we heard, and the struggle is reflected in a comment on the end of the manuscript. Great is the art of beginning, but greater the art is of ending. Well, overinflated a little bit it might be, but it certainly works here in the hall. And there were some thumbs up from the promenaders at the end of that performance for Vasily Zinaisky and the BBC Philharmonic. Stephen Bernard, principal viola. Big cheer and a handshake. And Peter Dixon, principal cello. They're about to go off on holidays. The orchestra slightly demob happy, I would hope. Jennifer Galloway, the oboist again. It's Richard Davis, the flute, and it will be John Bradbury, the clarinet. We're going through them all, I think. Well, Vasily Zinaisky is going to be a busy man come the autumn. He's chief conductor at the Bolshoi in Moscow now. They have a grand reopening after a seven-year refit on October the 26th. And he's conducting in its 100th year, would you believe, the first performances of Rosenkavalier ever in Russia, along with Boris Karmen and lots of other things. All the brass on their feet now. Vasily Zinaisky bringing the strings to their feet. BBC Phil, as I said, well-deserved break, then back with their new chief conductor, Juan Homena, in September. Mahler, the Second Symphony. Vasily Zinaisky back with Shostakovich 11, one of the few Shostakovich symphonies he's not conducted in his time at the Philharmonic in October, although he'll then be conductor emeritus. Well, tomorrow the Albert Hall turns into a huge movie house at 7 o'clock as the BBC Concert Orchestra and Keith Lockhart with violinist Chloe Hanslip bring the silver screen to the Proms. Live, of course, here on Radio 3, Walton, Bernard Herrmann, John Williams, Richard Rodney Bennett and others. A glorious cinematic kaleidoscope of sound. And don't forget the multitaskers of the Spaghetti Western Orchestra and their look at the scores of Ennio Morricone. They'll be saddling up at 10:15. Back on the platform comes Vasily Zinaisky. Lots of bow waving and cheering. They know it's his last concert as chief guest conductor, but he's not going away, as I said. Well, for now, from a bubbling Royal Albert Hall, time for me to hand you on to Broadcasting House into the safe hands of Sheriff John Shea.
Goodness me. Martin Handley, thank you very much. That was Martin presenting tonight's Prom live from the Royal Albert Hall. And as ever, there's another chance to hear the Prom online over the next 7 days. Anytime you like, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3 and follow the Listen Again links. If you're not an internet person, then you can hear it on Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Well, as you may know, this year we've been holding our first ever Proms Poetry Competition, a chance to hear a poem written by you performed in front of an audience as part of Proms Plus and then broadcast here on Radio 3. All you have to do is send in a poem inspired by one piece of music in this year's Proms. And we've extended the deadline for the competition now because there have been some technical problems with downloading the application form, as well as conflicting information about age categories. So, if you'd like to enter the Proms Poetry Competition, just go to the BBC Proms website, that's at bbc.co.uk/proms, follow the links to Ian McMillan's Proms Poetry page, and there you'll see that applications are still welcome until the extended closing date of next Monday, the 15th of August. Also there you'll find the details of how to apply, and clarification that there are three age categories, 7 to 11 years old, 12 to 18 and over 18. And of course, you'll find the competition's terms and conditions there as well. bbc.co.uk/proms.
Hi, I'm Tim Minchin, and this Saturday night, Radio 3 will be broadcasting live the world's first BBC comedy prom. I'll be hosting and performing, and will be joined by the wonderful Sue Perkins, the witty Kit and the Widow, the divine Susan Bullock, the digitally gifted Danny Driver, the incredible boy with tape on his face, Beatmaster Beardy Man, the hilarious Doc Brown, and the genius of Jules Buckley, vaguely waving his baton in the direction of the BBC Concert Orchestra. All the great classical traditions of the Proms treated with utter contempt by an ill-bred Antipodean and his silly friends. 7:30, Saturday night, on BBC Radio 3.
What is the world coming to? Well, our next programme this evening on Radio 3 is a feature reporting from the northern Indian city of Chandigarh, built to Nehru's instructions in the 1950s by the modernist architect Le Corbusier. You can hear that programme in about 10 minutes from now. It's followed by another in this week's series of Radio 3 essays on the Stuart kings who ruled Scotland in the Middle Ages. The essay is at 10:45, and then Fiona Talkington is here at 11 o'clock with Thursday's Late Junction. So, before our feature at 10 o'clock, more music by Gustav Holst. We heard his invocation for cello and orchestra in the second half of tonight's prom. This, though, is choral music, The Evening Watch, Holst's setting from 1924 of words by the 17th century metaphysical poet Henry Vaughan. It's a dialogue between the body, represented by two solo voices, and the soul, sung by the choir. Hilary Davin-Wetton conducts the Holst singers.
Thank you.
That was The Evening Watch by Gustav Holst. Hilary Davenwetten conducted the Holst Singers. Well, we've got time to hear one more piece from their disc before our next programme at 10 o'clock, and this is a setting that Holst made in 1915 of the Nunc Dimittis. He made it for Richard Terry, then organist of Westminster Cathedral, and after one liturgical performance, the piece remained forgotten until the 1970s. Davenwetten conducted the Holst Singers in Gustav Holst's setting of the Nunc Dimittis. This is BBC Radio 3. Do stay tuned for our feature coming next.
The question is not what you look at, but what you see.
The camera was no longer an instrument that recorded presences. It was a way of making the world disappear.
I know I change, have changed. But whose is this vapid face, suspended in empty paper, as though in a telescope?
From Auden Atwood and Oster to Leos Janacek and Charles Ives. On BBC Radio 3, music, poetry and prose inspired by centuries of photographs and photography, with Robert Powell and Geraldine James. The Photograph.
On the screen, we can only witness human behaviour. Choice is for camera crews.
An uninterrupted sequence of words and music. Sunday night at 10:15 on BBC Radio 3.
One dynasty above all others made its mark on Scottish medieval history, the Stuarts, Find out more in the essay in 45 minutes. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's now just gone 10 o'clock and time for tonight's feature. Sukhdev Sandhu travels to the northern Indian city of Chandigarh, built to Nehru's instructions for the new nation of India in the 1950s by the modernist architect Le Corbusier. How does the model state capital fare today in the era of Indian turbo-capitalism and megacities?
Welcome to Chandigarh. As you can see from the map in front of me, the city is divided into approximately 56 sectors. So each of these sectors is further divided into pockets known as A, B, C and D. So in order to get lost in Chandigarh, you'd have to be really, really challenged. I mean, your sense of direction would be majorly challenged.
Chandigarh was built for a new independent India in the 1950s by Le Corbusier. It was, and is, one of the very few totally planned cities in the world. In the era of turbo India, the India of megacities, how does Chandigarh look today?
He wanted to demolish Paris and rebuild it. I mean, no one permitted him to do that, and he had made similar plans for several other cities. This was actually the only case where he actually got a chance to have a city planned by him built.
They are masterpieces because he has not taken only advantage of the natural elements of sun, but he's also created monumental buildings, sculptures buildings, trying to fit in the functions of man into a building in a form that will look exotic, it's beautiful, and people should be proud to be living there.
I've seen Chandigarh when we were little and the roads used to be empty and it was so beautiful to come here. In fact, you know, the laws are a little lax in India, so at times we used to sit on top of the car and eat ice creams while travelling along the roads of Chandigarh.
The first time I encountered Chandigarh, it made no sense at all. When I was growing up, the only India I knew was ancient India. This place, a myth space really, was populated by bewhiskered gurus, sacred calligraphy, transfiguring peacocks and wolves. My parents, who had left the Punjab for England in the 1960s, substituting dark factory floors for the sunny, expansive cornfields where they had previously laboured, prized tradition and continuity in spite of, or perhaps because of, forsaking those very values in the act of migration. When, every few years or so, they returned to India, they sought out old haunts, old ways. Browbeaten aunties, wizened elders, humpbacked neighbours. Around and around they went, making tours of relatives and in-laws, dispensing fabrics, sipping cardamom tea, bemoaning local corruption with such lavish sighs it sounded like contented purring. This was the world they knew, the world that succoured them through what they claimed were their temporary sojourns abroad. To my youthful self, chafing and petulant, it all seemed grinding and hellish. I was afraid of the snakes, the mosquitoes, of getting diarrhea or something worse from the contaminated water we pumped from wells. The village we lived in seemed like a ghost town. Most of the ambitious young men had fled to Delhi or to Canada or to New York. Those who stayed sometimes died as they tried to reroute electricity illegally. So the only India I knew was a backwater, a temporary sanatorium for weary migrants, sustained by excruciating genealogies, a place peddled as verdant pastoral, but that seemed to me to be exhausted, posthumous. Then, one day, we went to Chandigarh. Why? I don't really know. Something to do with business, surely, for none of our family lived there. What was this place? It had proper roads, clean lines rather than dusty serpentine tracks. It was quieter, too, a tinnitus-inducing medley of hawkers and beggars and traffic honking found in other Punjabi cities couldn't be heard. Other sensual depletions. Colour, smell, animal dung. These absences were a puzzling come-on. As for the people, they moved briskly, were sturdy and full-bellied. They exuded the idiorhythms of power. This couldn't be India, could it? Chandigarh splintered the way I saw things, didn't fit into any paradigms I was familiar with. It lingered in my imagination for a long time as a series of befuddlements and mystery.
Chandigarh was planned by Le Corbusier in the early 50s, anticipating the private motor car taking over people's lives. And he had warned that this should not be permitted to happen because it was already happening in the West. Today, you see, it is hell to cross the Madhya Marg for a pedestrian because it's all been reoriented for fast movement of the private car.
The land prices right now in Chandigarh are amongst the top three in the world right now. Yeah. As far as other cities in the country are concerned, the facilities are way better. The management is way better. Your traffic is controlled in a much better manner. It has the charm of a small town with all the facilities that a big town has to offer. So you now have your malls and your shopping malls and your theaters and your multiplexes and your BMW showrooms and your Harley-Davidson showrooms, which have also opened up. But it's a small city, so that charm is there.
What are the stories that one hears here that one doesn't normally hear about Chandigarh? Chandigarh is often seen as a tourist destination, a place of power.
No, Chandigarh has two faces, like any other city. There's a lot of rich class and the poor class you can see here. And there is a poorer class than this also, where child labor is happening and all the hotels, all the shops, they have children working there. Like any other city, this city also has so much of migrant people and they are, trying to find a foothold and they're having more difficult time. There is a big gap.
You're obviously giving them some of the ingredients for a better future by some degree of control over their lives via education. What would you want the city to do to help them?
People and community have to come forward. They have to make a bridge for this class of people. Now that they have migrated, we should own them. Otherwise, there's so much anger in them. Crime is increasing, snatching and petty jobs, robberies. It's because of this only that the gap is increasing. So people of the city have to come forward and they have to give them whatever facilities we all can in our limited capacity. And the Chandigarh government should at least have some control on people, incoming of the people. So many people are coming. Already the population is 15 lakhs. The city was made for, I think, 5 to 7 lakh of people.
Chandigarh is a city built to alienate and to estrange. It's a concept machine, a laboratory for a future nation, pure political prestidigitation. Nehru, its sponsor, and the country's prime minister between 1947 and 1964, called it a temple of the new India. It really oughtn't to exist. Situated across the alluvial plains of Punjab, 250 kilometres north of Delhi, and near the foothills of the Himalayas, it's among the hottest places in all of India. Until the 1950s, there were no roads there, no train lines or electricity. For Nehru, Chandigarh was an attempt to rewrite India, to move from scripture to socialism. After independence, in 1947, he was eager to make his country modern, urban rather than rural, more in love with technology than ancient deities. He saw space in psychological terms. What he wanted was post-imperial architecture, the establishment from sun-baked nothingness of a city that represented modernity, futurism, a final deshackling of the Indian mind from its colonial mindset. The story of Chandigarh is also one of ghosts and of exorcism. It was an attempt on the part of India's ruling classes to atone for the psychological loss experienced by millions of Punjabi men and women after partition forced them to surrender their beloved city of Lahore to newly established Pakistan. For those refugees and newly displaced people, Chandigarh was meant to symbolise solidity, a brave new future, rehabilitation on a glorious scale. And so, looking for someone to make this vision a reality, Nehru turned to Charles-Édouard Généré-Gris, better known as Le Corbusier. It was, in some ways, an extraordinary decision. Le Corbusier is the Swiss-French architect who's widely regarded as the foremost theoretician and evangelist of European modernism. He's associated with Paris and Milan and Berlin, with automobiles and skyscrapers and airports. What appeal would a cheerleader for glass and geometry, for concrete and for straight lines, see in a country characterised by mud and straw shacks, by water buffaloes and bullock carts, by a reverence for tradition and continuity rather than high-rise utopianism? And what does a future city look like when the future has come and gone?
Now, we're now looking at the map of Chandigarh, where I'm going to identify some spots for you. 35, this is where I live, so I'm going to start with this. You're most likely to find flowers in this market over here. Then there's 34 sector, which has really good street Indian Chinese food. This is sector 22, where you're staying, which is right opposite the bus stand. It has a fabulous market, like a thrift market, where you get lots of export surplus textiles for very cheap rates. So that's a great place to do some economical shopping from. Oh, and of course, how can we not talk about Sector 17? Because that is supposed to be the heart of the city. That's where everybody goes to shop. And that's where on Saturday evenings or Friday evenings, everyone's dressed in their best clothes. So basically, from these sectors onwards, you enter into Mohali, which is a part of Punjab. It's a very blurry line because it's sort of like, you know, you're at a traffic light and then suddenly beyond that you're into another state, that's Mohali. This is where the chaos begins. Up till here, up till the 50s and, you know, 54s, everything is still organized. But then you get into Mohali and you're back into the real India, as some people would like to call it.
Chandigarh isn't a lofty metropolis. There aren't many vantage points from which to survey it. It's a grid city like Manhattan, but sliced and diced to create a far more powerful sense of uniformity and self-sufficiency. If you want to get a sense of its contours and structure, the best place is probably to look down at its manhole covers. India is renowned for its manhole covers. Many of those in Manhattan bear the inscription, "Made in India." Those in Chandigarh, though, are especially beautiful. They're moulded with sandcast reliefs that bear Le Corbusier's master plan for the city and depict its multiple sectors, the river to its north, Sukhna Lake towards the east. Manholes are often seen as portals for the imagination, time tunnels through which to access secret urban histories. Those covers in Chandigarh are a direct link to the first phase of the city's construction back in the 1950s and 1960s. Part of what makes them attractive is their lack of monumentality. In terms of size and scale, they represent a very different vision of what an urban spectacle could be than that you'd associate with Le Corbusier. Millions of Indian men and women have trodden and abraded them over the decades. It's becoming harder and harder to find them, though. The day I arrive, a local newspaper runs a story about a French auction house selling one for 20,000 euros. Maps, drawings, plans. Everything associated with Le Corbusier is worth big money now, even if the moonlighting soldiers or opportunistic locals who actually yank the cast iron manholes from the earth earn only a few hundred rupees for their efforts. In such forms is Chandigarh severed from its soil. In such forms is Chandigarh exported across to the first world as an artifact, a relic, an icon of retro-modernism. Concrete becomes plastic, materiality turns into mere symbol. A visionary place born of idealism is domesticated and commodified. Meanwhile, the other city, the real city, shapeshifts. It surges forward.
I'm S.D. Sharma. I started my career in Chandigarh, and I had the opportunity to work with Le Corbusier and his associates also, like Monsieur P. Genre, Maxwell Fry and Jane Bidu. This experience of working at Chandigarh is pretty unique, because in this, the most valuable thing was considered that this urbanism was based on aesthetics. Aesthetic is all over. If you see the sector plans, the grid, it's all on modular dimension. And Corbusier used this modular as a tool to achieve aesthetics, a harmony in the whole town, because through this tool, he wanted to achieve harmony in society, harmony in physical planning, and also equality in society, such sort of values. Then the architecture, as I talked, that it was pure architecture to begin with, where the versatility of very simple materials like concrete or brick was glorified. It was glorified along with the nature. Then we were taught that man must follow the nature.
Just as we are wearing suits today, we are wearing jeans today for our comfort. This has become common. Why? We are not wearing dhotis. How many men have you seen in dhotis here? So why should we live differently and think differently?
The architect M.N. Sharma worked alongside Le Corbusier in Chandigarh.
I think this house, anybody could live. You could live, I could live. Anyone can live. What difficulty do you find as an outsider in this house? Tell me. Is it Indian? But is it purely Indian from Indian point of for its climate, for the bricks, handmade, everything belongs to Chandigarh. Wood, everything. What else do you want? And this is international, then why can't architecture be international? Because human beings' comforts are the same. People used to squat on the floor and eat. And there was a discussion, what should we do? Because most women did not know how to stand and cook. We made houses with a sitting cooking place and higher. And today there's no lady sitting down and cooking. So, architect can be a social reformer, provided he himself is on the right track. He's not thinking of his own. He's thinking of the comfort of man, not of rich man and poor man, no. The city is meant for all classes of people, lowest of the low and highest of the high. The problem is this city has attracted too many people from other states for construction and even for better living, because they're all comforts here. Even they come for jobs and squat, and our slums are increasing because even neighboring satellite towns have not provided enough civic infrastructure. So it's all being thrown at Chandigarh. Chandigarh is suffering because of its beauty and good architecture.
No matter what you design for the poor, they never seem to get it.
Madhu Sarin is a developmental planner. Her father was one of the first lawyers to come to the city.
Le Corbusier had said Chandigarh is going to be a city for the poorest of the poor to live with dignity. Now, how did they provide for living with dignity for the poorest of the poor? They said the smallest house in the city would have to be a two-room pakka house with pipe water supply, electricity, toilet, kitchen, everything. And so you say this is the minimum house. But the laborers who were building the city, I mean, they were earning 1 rupee, 12 annas a day. There's no way they could do it. They could afford anything like that. So you can't say that if people live in this sector, that all the children of the sweeper cleaning this person's house and this owner's children are going to go to the same school simply because it's the nearest. You know, The rich will send their kids to the best schools and the poorest one will send to wherever it's cheapest or there's a functioning government school. So location has no connection. So basically, because of the planning's focus on physical standards and physical layout, if you look at the socioeconomic pyramid, it excluded the bottom of the pyramid totally. So what you got was actually a parallel, what they call informal sector, which again is a vague term, but there's a parallel non-legal city of both housing, enterprises, production, services, self-generation of self-employment, which is actually the foundation on which the rest of the city stands. The rest of the city couldn't have been built without those people.
Nehru believed that India idolized the past. Its love of antiquity, of tradition itself, was, he felt, a kind of choke lock. He craved pioneers, urban cosmonauts, a new breed of Indian, unfettered by the gravity of caste and customs. What would he make of India today? It's full of cities, megalopolises, grand suburbs. Its economy has been liberalized, protectionism giving way to the free-for-all of contemporary globalization. Public space is privatized, public broadcasting losing ground to the cacophonies of 24/7 cable. The language of social justice that animated so many Hindi films in the 1950s and 60s, supplanted by the gaudy fud and cretinous bling of Bollywood fare. India is a factory of nouns. There, on the billboards and business pages, above the congested highways, and in the advertisements in thick, glossy men's magazines, the nouns come spilling out, a collective spam euphoria that peons acquisition, packaging, bond markets, high-tech, liquidity, monorails, IPOs, capitalization, capital expenditure. The function of space, of the nation's landscape itself, is to serve as test sites for these abstractions, to help them become concrete. These days, more than six decades after the end of empire, India is another kind of myth space. Only now, it references the future, not the past. Along with nations such as China and Brazil, it's portrayed by economists and political commentators as a rival to Western hegemony. So many doctors and engineering students, so much IT know-how and outsourced labor. Go east, young man. India is shining. There, in Bangalore, in Chennai, in Hyderabad, are the cities that are said to be imparting valuable lessons, not just to the rest of the nation, but to the world. Nehru placed his hopes in planning. Chandigarh was meant to be a tabula rasa, an effort to begin India again anew. It's a future city that was constructed out of loyalty to concepts that India's current future cities, ever more wedded as they are to deregulation and anti-planning, would regard as anathema. Is planning always a neo-colonialist project? Is it always likely to struggle in a nation as teeming as India? Sam Miller is author of Delhi, Adventures in a Megacity, and a resident in the capital.
The attempt the planners made over the years to zone this city into industrial areas and commercial areas and residential areas representing different income groups and so on have been partially successful, but I would say probably quite damaging. And they've often been totally overridden by local people. It's very hard when you're planning, as they were in this city, for a population of 5 million, when actually the population, if they'd looked at it, if they'd followed their own censuses, they would have known that the population was already 8 or 9 million by then. So they were endlessly, in planning this city, they were using an imagined city that wasn't the real place, again, where people live. And I think planned cities around the world, particularly where the cities already existed in some form or another, have suffered terribly from this, that someone's had an idea, and it may be a marvelous grand idea, but does it relate to what's already there? Does it relate to the way people live? Does it relate to the climate? Does it relate to a whole series of things which are actually what people care about in their everyday lives? But India is full of partially successful attempts at planned cities. Delhi has a series of planned cities that go back to the 12th century. Jaipur, famously built in the 18th century to a 3x3 plan of the inside the walled pink city as it is now known. Obviously, more recently, we've had Chandigarh, we've had other planned cities, state capitals like Gandhinagar and Bhubaneswar in other parts of the country. And there's a way in which they are built and then they become something that you try and encroach on. That there's something you go in and you try and change this law, or you build something secretly that undermines the spirit of that well-ordered person who wasn't actually going to end up living in this place themselves. And I think that's happened again and again and again.
What everyone in Delhi always asks you is, have you been to Gurgaon?
Gurgaon sits at the sort of southern tip of Delhi, and it's really bills itself as a big new high-tech city, and it's got lots of very high buildings, and lots of multinationals have moved over there, and I think it's quite easy to get good wireless connections and things like that. But it emerged where it did because they weren't allowing any more building in Delhi. And it's partly a consequence of the failure of the planning of Delhi that we have this city that's grown up right against the border of the city. And this new city that's built up against the border of Delhi. It wasn't planned at all. Sewer lines were constructed after buildings. So it, for a lot of residents there, it has felt like a permanent building site and still can be like that. But you could argue that it lives, it meets the dreams or the kind of desires of a large number of Indians who want something that is recognizably international. They want to live in a place with lots of shopping malls. They want to live in a flat that's well looked after, often by someone else rather than being their own responsibility. There are people who will say moving there has just been the greatest thing in their lives. But it's strikingly different from where we are here today because there are enormous great towers. And there's lots of glass and concrete. And here, what do we see? We see grass and stone. In some ways, these are the materials out of which a city would have been built 1,000 years ago, even though this one was only built really in the 20s.
How does Gurgaon compare as a visionary city in comparison to Chandigarh or to here in where we are in Delhi?
There was no vision behind Gurgaon, where there clearly was behind Chandigarh. The laying out of the city in Gurgaon was haphazard. It depended on developers rather than town planners buying plots of land off farmers. And they would literally go down there, they would drive down there with sackfuls of money and say, I want that field. And there'd be a field missing. So they couldn't build there. And you'll still see that in the shape of some of the plots and the land in Gurgaon. So to call Gurgaon planned is, it just isn't. Whereas Chandigarh certainly is, though you could argue that the areas around it have been a response to other needs of that city, which weren't met by the planners.
I like cities that are compacted, where people squeeze and jostle, where friction and juxtaposition are engines of new, concussive forms of knowledge. Chandigarh offers a more decorous urbanism. It does have retail sectors with public squares offering purchasing power democracy, but even these are becalmed and tranquil, as befits a capital with so many wealthy, respectable inhabitants. A city with sectors, one in which each sector, 800 metres by 1,200 metres, is geared towards self-sufficiency in education, worship, and shopping. This is, in many ways, a fine and perhaps ecologically responsible design for living. But as you move around, it can be hard to distinguish one part of a city from another. With few tall buildings to act as landmarks, the sectors become mushy. They exert an anti-force field of emotion. I begin to feel a bit like a rat in a laboratory maze. The grid is an open prison. Young kids in Chandigarh go out to clubs, they go out to bars, they hang out in each other's gardens. They loiter amidst the congestions they find and crave in cyberspace. But the real city is not meant to be for the young. It's manicured and tweezed, more retirement home than playground. They're not interested in celebrating the city's foundation narratives. That's all ancient history for them. But as yet, they haven't been able to forge new identities for the place. Perhaps they're not poor enough or desperate enough. Perhaps they're victims of affluence. They certainly seem to be lacking compulsion.
It's already changing quite a lot, and you see, big flats coming up. And I think that's something that the government maybe needs to think about and control.
Simi Varesh is a psychiatrist in one of the city's hospitals.
A lot of people are scared that that's going to spoil the spirit of the city. If you have all these huge flats all over the place, it's going to place a lot of burden on the immediate surroundings, in the form of traffic and parking. And because now each house has 5-6 cars and there's no place for parking, and the roads don't have enough space for those cars. So the government needs to think about long-term planning and, how they're going to deal with things 20 years from now, instead of just taking it one step at a time. And every time they feel the traffic is too much, they'll break the roundabout in one area and put up a traffic light. But they're not thinking long term. They need to put up some laws and have some plan over there, a long term plan, I think.
It sounds incredible to me that you say many houses have 5-6 cars. That sounds like America, or that sounds like kind of auto-geddon.
Yeah, I think that's the sad part about India. I mean, it's like I grew up with my grandparents and everything, and you had one refrigerator and one car. And my grandfather used to go on his scooter. He wouldn't drive his car around the place. You have this big family subsisting on one refrigerator, one oven. You didn't need a microwave in those days. And buying a TV also was a big thing, and you used to have one television. But now everyone has separate televisions in bedrooms, and you have a separate refrigerator on each floor. Even if they're extended families where everyone is living separately. So even one nuclear family has two cars and a couple of scooters or something. But scooters are fast going out, it's just cars now.
People who go to Chandigarh are pilgrims. They're awe-hungry, in quest of the modernist sublime, for proof of modernism's global possibilities. One place on the itinerary of every avant-garde Odyssean is the Assembly Building in Sector 1. It's home to the governments of Punjab and Haryana, where the region's politicians meet and pass legislation. Together with the Secretariat and the High Court, it's one of three monumental buildings in the city most associated with Le Corbusier. It's stately, supremely intelligent, its roof featuring a pyramid tower and an obliquely truncated cupola designed to help make the structure resemble a giant bull astride the local plains. In 1962, Le Corbusier gifted the Assembly a multi-panelled mosaic, a cubist riot of flaming colours that's flecked with symbols and icons, with snakes and bulls and tortoises. These are the great architect's insignia, the images that crop up repeatedly in monographs and exhibitions dedicated to him, the images of Chandigarh best known to the world. However, if, after facing the mural, you spin around 180 degrees, another picture emerges. It's that of a ghosted airstrip, an abandoned construction site. On the ground lies a quiet flotsam of foam, wood, printed speeches from retired governors. The nearby moat is still, feculent. On the left is meant to stand a governor's house. On the right, a museum of knowledge. But neither exist. And before you lies a concrete flatland that gently slopes all the way down to High Courts. There, just about visible through a clump of trees, is the open hand, a 26-metre-high human palm, designed to symbolise the spirit of the city, open to give and open to receive. But the assembly is mostly not open. The Chief Minister of Punjab was killed here in 1996, and since then, there's been a constant war on terror. Armed guards patrol the grounds, blocking it off to all but the most credentialed guests and VIPs. Inside, there's a visitor's book, a breeze-block-sized ledger, only 9 of whose many hundreds of pages have been filled over the course of many decades. As for local people, there's nothing here for them. Dogs, dozing in the midday heat, like it fine, but as even a partial embodiment of a radiant city, this place falls well short. The assembly building may function as shorthand for Chandigarh, but in its enervation, in its remoteness, it feels out of time, lost in its own spaciousness.
When you were working, yourself and your colleagues, did you feel you were embarked upon a kind of patriotic project? Did you feel that what you were doing was a kind of nation building?
You know, it is through architecture is the greatest discipline in the world, through which the history survives. For example, it is through architecture only we talk about Greek architecture, Roman architecture, Mohenjo-daro, Harappa, and so on. Because of architecture, everything else has perished. But these monuments, architectural monuments, they stay, and they have given, architecture has given name of civilizations, to civilizations. And this is the importance. And this open hand and capital complex building, Corbusier was very conscious that maybe in the history, these things will stay like that, that they talked about a particular period, that yes, this was the 20th century.
On my last day in Chandigarh, I go to its power centre, the secretariat building that houses the headquarters of the Punjab and Haryana governments. It's 10 stories high, the loftiest building in the capital complex. Le Corbusier thought of the city as a body, and the secretariat was meant to be its head. Reason, sound thinking, practical logic, these all emanate from here. Myself, I want to climb to the head of a head, to go to its roof and finally look out across Chandigarh, to savour the opportunity to fully comprehend the city that befuddled me as a child and that has fascinated me ever since. Le Corbusier championed tall buildings. Even if he wasn't able to make Chandigarh as toweringly vertical as he might have at one stage wished, it seems sensible to avail myself of the Archimedean perspective to get the bigger picture. It's not easy to do this. The sentries and soldiers at the site are quizzical, officious. They want paperwork, then more paperwork, and then some more paperwork. Eventually, I'm led up into an office that is itself a veritable empire of paperwork. A musty, patchy, air-conditioned shrine to governmental bureaucracy, in which old files, old typewriters, and pens so old they may as well be quills, fill most of the available space not taken by mild, middle-aged officials who have refined the art of sheaf-shuffling, chit-rustling procrastination to quite extraordinary levels of inanition, manufacturing in the process an anti-modern kingdom that's as far removed from the information superhighway striated republic that contemporary India likes to advertise itself as becoming. Finally, I get my clearance and bound up onto the